In his now American classic, The Souls of Black Folk, W.E.B. Du Bois, who was one of the foremost Black intellectuals of the late 19th and 20th centuries, wrote that the problem of the 20th century was the problem of the color line. Or, to be more specific, he said that navigating relations between the darker and lighter races of men in Asia and Africa, in America and the islands of the sea, would occupy much time and thought. Looking at the ongoing challenges that we face with issues of race and racism, one wonders if Du Bois's view of the 21st century would be any different. While many might be inclined to think that these are uniquely American problems, recent reports about racial and social unrest in Europe reveals that they are not. As reported in the New York Times earlier this year, France, a nation that bills itself as committed to the universalist idea of the brotherhood and equality of all, has been significantly convulsed by racial protests in recent months. Those protests, which grew out of the global reaction to the tragic murder of George Floyd last year, have prompted many French politicians and intellectuals to voice concerns about what they see as a growing influence of woke and anti-racist activism in France. According to French President Emmanuel Macron, the threat of certain social science theories entirely imported from the United States is fueling secessionism and gnawing at national unity in France. Is this true, or is it that French intellectuals and politicians are living in a state of denial, especially when it comes to issues of race and the problem of systemic racism in France? Marcus and I will pose these and other questions to our guest and colleague, Dr. Oliver Gloag, on today's show. Oliver, who has joined us before, is a native of France and has a unique perspective on that country and its fraught history around the issues of race and colonialism. We look forward to having you with us today. Welcome to another episode of the Waters and Harvey Show. I'm Darren Waters.
And I'm Marcus Harvey.
And again, we're glad to have you all join us again today. We're so glad and grateful for all of the members of the audience. Marcus, I just have to take a moment here at the very beginning of the show just to acknowledge, you know, the support that we're getting from so many members of the audience. We are kind of slow sometimes in responding to people and your requests for our comments or, you know, ideas that you all may have. But trust me, Marcus and I are trying our best to get to that, aren't we, brother?
Yeah, we are. And I really do continue to be just astonished and also encouraged by the not only the regularity with which, you know, we're getting feedback on the show, but also the sort of the reflective nature of the feedback that we get. Mm-hmm. It really tells me that our listeners, many of our listeners, are not just listening to the show passively, but they're listening actively, and they're wrestling with the conversations that we are exploring on the show. So that to me is a very positive sign.
It is. It's like, you know, Marcus, I feel that each time we get together, we're jumping in the deep end, you know, mm-hmm. once again into the pool of knowledge, just kind of exploring different topics, different ideas. And it is so good to hear the feedback from you all about how that is, as Marcus said, causing you all to be reflective. We got one message from one listener who said, you know, thank you for making me think, which Marcus, really is the purpose of the show. And I'm glad that we seem to be introducing new topics in a way, are maybe even old topics in a way that people hadn't thought about them before. And I think that even with the conversations that we've recently yeah. had on reparations, you know, we continue to get feedback on that live version of the show that we did. And then there's a shortened version that aired here on Blue Ridge Public Radio. So you can get that podcast to listen to it. But I continue to get feedback from people because, Marcus, this conversation on reparations is going to be an ongoing conversation for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. And I would just say, I appreciate the listener writing in to us and saying that she appreciates the show giving her an opportunity to think, because I know that unfortunately we live in a society that increasingly, at least North America, that increasingly encourages kind of reactive action rather than action preceded by serious reflection. So, so any opportunity that I have to encourage people to pause and think before acting, I'm happy
absolutely
to take full advantage of.
So absolutely.
I appreciate that comment. Yeah.
So Marcus, I think here, you know, the last show that we did with, which was kind of a reflection show, but a different model of the reflection show that we did on the conversation, the larger conversations around reparations. And we did that show because we've been working in partnership with the William Friday Fellowship of the Wild Acres Leadership Initiative, which is the umbrella organization for the William Friday Fellowship for Human Relations. And those have been ongoing conversations. You and I pointed out in that last show that one of the things we deeply appreciate about the work with the Friday Fellows is that it's giving us an opportunity to speak to people throughout the state of North Carolina, across the state of North Carolina, not just here locally, but it gives us a glimpse of what is going on in communities across the state. And I thought it was an interesting show. I mean, we had Ryan Emanuel, Dr. Ryan Emanuel, who is a member of the Lumbee tribe, and to hear his perspective on issues related to reparations, I thought was very instructive, as it was with Angie McEver, who is right here in the local community, but a member of the current class of fellows, and her perspective. And, you know, one of the things struck me about her comments, Marcus, and you can respond here, was how she said, okay, we need to be thinking about this whole issue of reparations in a very personal way. We need to think about it, not just as a collective, but how can we think about it in a very personal way? And it reminded me of a King Prater. And it seems that King Prater, who was on that live show with us, is also attempting to think about this in a very personal way.
Yeah, and I think her point, I think Angie's point, it really issues a kind of charge directly, I think, to the white American community specifically, right? To not fall back on the comfortable move of thinking about reparations as something extrinsic to me, as something out there, as an issue out there that doesn't directly impact me, as something out there that the government will resolve either on the local, state, or federal level. No. Angie really was saying that, you know, this is something that that white America needs to personalize, right? And think of as an issue that that forms a significant part of their life, right? Their social life, their personal life, etc., in the United States. And so, and I think perhaps in a less direct way, King Prater's comments on the live show on reparations issued a similar kind of charge to white America, to really begin to engage this question of reparations in a personalized way. It remains to be seen how effective that charge will be, but I think it is an important charge to make, especially right now.
Right. And Marcus, I can't help but think about the framing questions that you and I have been using, have kind of be reiterating in so many of the most recent shows about who are we and who do we want to be. And I think that this conversation around reparations, and especially as we move towards 2026, which you and I both have referenced, which will be the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence and the beginning of the American Revolution, that this gives us an opportunity to kind of revisit those questions of who are we and who do we wish to be. And I think that the conversation around reparations invites maybe an engagement with those two questions and thinking about the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution. Well, look, here we are here again today. And the conversation, I guess it relates to the conversations that we've had in the most recent shows around reparations. But you and I have been thinking about, well, it does, because this is really about the issue of race, right? But we can become so, I guess, myopic in the way that we think about this, and we only think about it as it relates to us here at home or here in the United States. But what's going on around the issues of race globally? And you and I in our private conversations have been talking about that a bit. And for one, it was prompted by an article that appeared in the New York Times back in February, which was talking about the issue of race, and especially from the perspective of France. And it seems that there is a bit of angst in the country, in the nation of France, about some of the conversations that we're having here in the United States around race. And so you and I have been privately talking about that and wanted to come back to, okay, let's engage this topic in a more globalized perspective, which we've done before in a past show with Dr. Oliver Gloag, who we've already said is going to be joining us here today. But this gives us a chance to kind of revisit that conversation.
Yeah, it does. And to me, the case of France is ironic, right? Right, in a sense, because, you know, here we have a European nation with a history of colonization that dates back to at least the 18th century, right? So the 1700s. It also imagines itself to be really an Enlightenment nation. And we know that the idea of race, right, really begins to appear in intellectual circles during the Enlightenment, right? Many of the formative thinkers of the Enlightenment were French thinkers. So to me, it's very ironic that that France finds itself right now in a position where, at least at the national level, it cannot confront right the role that race played and continues to play in its colonial history. And so right. I think it's entirely apropos, right, as we sort of pivot, at least on this show, to the question of race from a global perspective, to the specific case of France.
Right. And I think, and for those of you in the audience who are curious about what article Marcus and I are kind of referencing here that was in the New York Times back in February, the title of that article was actually "Will American Ideas Tear France Apart? Some of its leaders think so." And so if anyone's paying attention, there are a lot of comments that are being made, even by the French president, Emmanuel Macron, who is talking about this as well, about American ideas and America's woke culture. We hear that term a lot. You and I have not really used that term here on the show, but, you know, maybe, it, you know, at some point it, that will be a conversation as to come back to. But Marcus, a lot of this has been prompted, as you and I both know, by the murder of George Floyd last year, right? So we not only saw protests here in the United States, but we saw major protests globally. And that begs the question, you know, what's going on in these other nations, right?
Yeah, I think so. And this concern in France about the impact of what we might call woke leftism coming from the United States, to me is interesting when you consider the fact, and I'm sure that I know that we'll get more into this when we bring Professor Gloag in. But when you consider, for example, for instance, the atrocities committed by France in places like Algeria, right, Madagascar, for example, the last three French prime ministers, right, so that would be Emmanuel Macron, that would be François Hollande, and also Nicolas Sarkozy, have refused to offer public apologies, right, specifically for the atrocities in Algeria. So to me, it's interesting to sort of blame what's happening in France now on American woke culture, when it seems to me that this kind of this sentiment in France, this sentiment involving a disinterest in discussing race and a disinterest in confronting France's colonial history seems to predate American woke culture, in my opinion. So it seems that you know, American woke culture has become a kind of convenient scapegoat.
Yeah, right, the whipping ball.
To explain what's happening right now in France, right, as far as the upheaval around race.
Right. And so, Marcus, as you and I prepped for this show, and I thought about what is going on globally, and in this case, particularly in France, and what we're reading, I could not help but think about W.E.B. Du Bois, right? And the Souls of Black Folks, and what he said in 1903 when that book was published. And in the introduction of that book, he said that the problem of the 20th century would be the problem of the color line. So it makes me wonder, what would he say today? I like to think that in the Souls of Black Folks, a book. Let me just say here that one of our favorite historians, Dr. David Blight, says that every American should read The Souls of Black Folks. He said, I have seen him tell Yale students that if they have not read this text before they graduate from Yale, then they do not deserve to have a degree from Yale. So I kind of agree. It is one of the books that is in the American canon that should be read. I like to think that maybe Du Bois was hopeful about where we might be by the time the 21st century dawned. But it seems to me, Marcus, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, it seems to me that the problem of the 21st century is still the problem of the color line.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really don't think that Du Bois, I would suggest speculatively that Du Bois likely did not expect this color line issue to be resolved at any point in the future. As I read Du Bois, it wasn't just that the color line was considered to be the preeminent problem of the 20th century. I think we can sort of read into Du Bois's analysis the implication that the color line really, or we could say race or colorism, right? Really, in many ways, was and is the definitive problem of modernity itself, right? So mm-hmm. I don't know how you resolve something that is so we say embedded or endemic in modernity, right? Mm-hmm. As the kind of contemporary environment that we live and breathe every day. So I think the language that Du Bois has given to this problem helps us talk about it, you know, in a clearer, more precise way. But as far as resolving this whole question of the color line or race or racism, I highly doubt that Du Bois, you know, would have expected a resolution by this point, especially given that by the end of Du Bois's career, Du Bois says, you know what, to hell with the US, I'm expatriating to West Africa. Right, I'm gonna live out my days here. This is after having spent his entire life, right, working on the race issue in the United States.
You're listening to the Waters and Harvey Show on Blue Ridge Public Radio. We'll be back after a short break. Stay with us. You're listening to the Waters and Harvey Show on Blue Ridge Public Radio. We're discussing the global impact of Black Lives Matter, woke culture, and racial justice protests in the United States, the impact of those globally. Our guest today is Dr. Oliver Globe. Oliver is an associate professor of French and Francophone studies at UNC Asheville, a wonderful colleague. And Marcus, I'm just glad to go ahead and just invite Oliver into this conversation now. He's someone that many of our listeners will probably be familiar with because he was on the show with us back in 2014. And it seems, 2017, 4 years ago. And it seems amazing to me that actually 4 years has passed since we've had Oliver back. But I think a lot has been going on with him. But Oliver, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to kind of join us in this conversation today. We look forward to just a rich discussion.
Oh, well, I'm glad to be back and thanks for having me.
So let's just get started. I mean, a lot has transpired since the last time we talked with you. One thing in particular that we want to congratulate you on is on the publication, I think this of your first book, right, with the University of Oxford Press, a book entitled Albert Camus, A Very Short Introduction. And so, Oliver, congratulations on the publication of this book.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
In fact, I think we'd like to just start the conversation with talking about the book briefly here, because I think we're going to find as the conversation goes along that it connects very well with the conversation we're having. So what can you tell us about this book? It was published, I think, in 2020, but what can you tell us about this work?
Well, as the title of the collection suggests, it's meant to be an introduction to Albert Camus, who is perhaps the most widely read French writer in the English language. He's a novelist, a playwright, a philosopher, even though he didn't call himself that. And it's an introduction to his life and works. It's also an analysis of the cultural phenomenon that Camus has become, and also of his contradictions. He was both the son of the French Republic in the sense that he benefited from free schooling. His father was killed during World War I. He grew up in a very poor background. And thanks to this free education afforded by the French state, I mean, he ended up getting the Nobel Prize of Literature. This is an amazing feel-good story. And he was he saw himself on the side of disenfranchised, oppressed people. And in some ways he was, but at the same time, he was fervently attached to France's colonial presence in the area. 150 years of occupation that we'll talk about later. And so Camus was both for emancipation and ultimately a supporter of colonialism, so against emancipation. And I think, and so he was a supporter of colonialism. In this, so there's an intractable, unresolvable contradiction in Camus himself that, in my view, and I try to explain this in the book, powers his works. Powers is that contradiction is the matrix for his works and makes him a fascinating culture, fascinating figure. Now, this unnamed contradiction and often unacknowledged contradiction that, you know, where Camus is between metropolitan colony is in fact, I think, the same contradiction that pervades France today in all sorts of ways.
So, you know, Marcus, before you jump in here, I'd just like to ask Oliver, I mean, for some who might think, well, why are we talking about a French philosopher here? But he is very popular internationally, right? So, I mean, there are a lot of Americans who, from George W. Bush himself, you know, who you write about, who is someone here in this country who has referenced Camus. And so what is it with this global popularity of this figure?
Well, that's a very good question. In a way, if you'd like, he's the incarnation of the fiction of a colonialism with a humanist face. With a human, you know, sort of like, well, yes, colonialism with a human face, as it were. This idea that you can be both a humanist, both for enlightenment, and at the same time for colonialism, that there can be a generous colonialism. And that is extremely appealing for leaders in Europe and the United States, especially like George Bush, when they're about to invade Iraq for a second time in 10 years. Mm-hmm.
And this is such a fascinating point, Oliver. And there's, I wanted to query you a little bit about the complexity, a little bit more about the complexity in Camus that you just sort of discussed. I'm reminded of a statement, a very brief statement that Camus made, which you wrote about in an article you published with the Jacobin not too long ago, where a student asked Camus about justice. And Camus' response was, I would choose my mother before justice, right? So this to me just kind of speaks to the kind of internal contradiction in Camus with respect to France's colonial history and legacy, and also his sort of post-colonial, or so we say anti-colonial inclinations in some way. So I'm curious to hear a little bit more from you, Oliver, about what you think is the source of that contradiction, right? I mean, is it just a function of his Camus being a Frenchman, right? And also influenced by sort of the emergence of anti-colonial movements, or is just something else it worked there, do you think?
Well, it's a function first, I think, of the fact that he grew up in French Algeria, that he is, for all intents and purposes, a settler colonialist. So his home was Algeria. And when he says, and there are disputes about the exact quote, that he would choose his mother as opposed to justice, it's also an admission. He is admitting that the very life of his mother in Algeria is premised on injustice. And so it's also a confession, even though it was not interpreted as such. But Camus was torn because he was on the side of emancipation, of public schooling for all, of free healthcare, of which he benefited from. But at the same time, he was very well aware that although he had a very poor childhood, it would have been much worse if he had been an Arab. And he says that. So the source of this contradiction, it is the contradiction of France itself. The lofty rhetoric, liberté, égalité, fraternité, and the colonial practices. And it's been easier for France to do than the United States of America, because for a long time in its history, the colonial oppression was invisible. It was in the colonies. It was far from sight. And now it's coming back, and it's visible because of immigration, because of globalization, and because of technology in the world we're around today. So it's really becoming untenable. And Camus serves almost as camouflage for this. Even he himself was torn by it. And that's one of the many paradoxes.
So Oliver, what is it about us in the West where we have a difficult time admitting the paradoxes and the contradictions that exist in us all? It just strikes me. And I'm wondering, what can we learn? What can we learn from the fact that you're highlighting these contradictions and these paradoxes that existed within Camus himself? I mean, what can that teach us? And here, I think this is something that, I'm reminded of other people like Abraham Lincoln himself. And you and I have discussed this, Marcus and I have discussed it, who we like to think historically of them as being absolute consistence. In fact, we have a tendency to make of these people, these historical figures, to remake them in an image that they probably wouldn't recognize themselves if they actually came back and they saw these images. And so I think of, and I've often quoted a statement by W.E.B. Du Bois about Lincoln and his contradictions. And he ends that quote by saying that that he sees this as what made him human, that he was a big, inconsistent, brave man and was willing to be inconsistent. So I'm wondering, what can we learn from addressing and acknowledging that these contradictions and these paradoxes actually exist in all of us as human beings?
Well, I think the first thing that is useful to be able to actually demythify these figures like Lincoln, like Camus, and I was going to mention Lyndon Johnson, is to really look at history, because that serves to give the context. And then to go back to what Marcus said, to also look at modernity and to figure to see that nations were created out of modernity, and for economic and political reasons, that the very notion of nation is in opposition to monarchy, and that we need secular saints, right? We need idealized figures. And I was going to mention, yes, Lyndon Johnson, if you read Carroll's excellent biography, you find out that Lyndon Johnson was not just the figure who said we shall overcome, but who blocked civil rights legislation in the Senate for decades. Or for certainly many years, and that there's in fact a systemic motivation behind oppressive rules and laws, and sometimes a systemic motivation behind rules and laws that free people from oppression. Mm. And that's something also that's interesting to look at.
Yeah, and I'm thinking also of Oliver and Darren that the trouble with being willing to openly wrestle with contradictions that show up, right, in prominent Euro-Western figures like Camus, like Abraham Lincoln, as Darren was mentioning earlier. It seems to me is that once you do that, you're now messing with the process of sort of myth building with respect to, you know, this idea of Euro-Western exceptionalism, right? This idea that that the Western world is a kind of exemplar that the rest of the world should look up to, right, and emulate and seek out for guidance, etc. But this sort of hard work of dealing with internal contradictions, it seems to me, chips away and also exposes, I think, the sort of mythic foundation, the mythic foundations of Euro-Western identity. So I think that's another issue at play here. But Oliver, you yourself are a Frenchman, right? You grew up in France. And so I'm curious to hear, just on a more basic level, What was that experience like? Did you experience race as a factor in France? Before the show, you and I were talking briefly about the fact, and I'm still flabbergasted by this, that France does not allow statistics on race to be compiled. I'm still sort of flabbergasted about it. Anyway, curious to hear from you, Oliver, about what your experience was like growing up in France, and did you experience race? Was race a part of your experience?
Well, let me preface this by saying that, of course, my comments in terms of the experience of race is from the experience from the perspective of a white middle class Parisian, and that's important to note. On the other hand, of course, I'm also a descendant of German and Jewish refugees, some of whom died with the complicity of the French state at the end of World War II. And so my reverence for the French state and the myth of France as a land of universalism, enlightenment, was very limited from the get-go. Mm. So that needs to be said. And I'll say this, you know, race, when I grew up in school, because the schooling was based on district, there was no busing. It was very, very white. And in terms of education, I mean, it was extremely problematic. It was very, very few mentions of colonialism outside of sort of complimentary comments, and no mentions of any massacres or anything like that. And so on the one hand, race is absent from the educational curriculum. I'm talking about, you know, primary, middle, high school. It's completely absent. But then when you go to the streets of Paris, the French society is blind to everything but color. And if you are of Algerian descent, of Maghrebi descent, if you're Black, you're going to get stopped by the police if you're under 30 years old. So one sees that. And then the news is, there's a constant stream of young Arab and young African men being killed by the police. And the big emblematic moment in my life and in the life of a generation of French women and men was in 1986. There was a big demonstration against the privatization of the French university system. And this demonstration, you know, there were hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people in the streets of Paris. And one night the police attacked a group of people and killed a young man of Algerian descent. And that was a huge moment that led to a huge outcry on the part of French youth, but not at all atypical. So it's a society that is in a sort of a state-funded and sponsored delusion that race doesn't matter. And let me just end with one quick anecdote. When you refer to a Black person in French, there is an aversion to say the word noir. And French kids in the 80s and 90s would say the word black. So they, you know, in this sort of trying to sort of dilute it. And so it's even in the way that people speak to one another, there's a negation of race.
So Oliver, you've brought up a point here, a term, and let's just kind of dig into it a little bit. Can you explain to us and our listeners a little bit more this concept of universalism in France? What is that? And because it is it's a fundamental tenet of what it means to be French, right? Can you just explain for us a little bit what this term means?
Absolutely. Well, we have to go back a little bit. I think the notion of universalism really grows out of the Enlightenment, and it is a concept, an idea that's meant to really challenge monarchies and societies that are built on a sort of super essentialism, right? You're born in a specific family. So universalism becomes this notion, and it's very linked with modernity and capitalism, where you know, you are what you do, how much work you perform, and so on, and we're all created equal. This is to create essentially a nation where people are citizens, not subjects, and this is idea of complete equality. But of course, as we know, it's also used often as a mask and as a way to legitimate, in fact, imperialism. And in fact, behind universalism, that's sort of, it's sort of the rhetoric behind the revolution of 1789, which in many ways was a bourgeois revolution. And when you look at the Declaration of the Man and the Citizen, La Déclaration de l'Homme et du Citoyen in 1789, the very first article is about protecting property. Men of African descent are slaves in the French system, and so they're considered property. So this universalist declaration does not emancipate them, because ultimately the value of bourgeois universalism is commerce, by any means necessary. And so that universalism confronts itself with another universalism, which is a universalism that takes the rhetoric, let's say, at face value. And there were societies of white bourgeois Frenchmen, Société des Amis des Noirs, who were for the abolition of slavery. They went over in 1794, but they don't really, that's not why slavery was abolished in France in 1794. It was because there were riots, there were uprisings in Saint-Domingue, which later becomes Haiti, and they had to keep the peace, and so they had to abolish slavery. So really, it's pressure from the colonies, from the slaves who are fighting and who have forced the revolution to keep up with their rhetoric. And therein lies the interest of universalism and the universalist rhetoric, is that even though it may not have been originally sincere, it gets taken up by people in what becomes Haiti and later by Ho Chi Minh, and they take them at face value and they say, all right, we're going to take your words and put you in front of your contradictions. So universalism is sort of a double-edged sword. You could say there are two. There's one that's about rebellion against injustice of all people, and it starts with the history of humanity in Carthage, the rebellion of the slaves and the mercenaries, going to Spartacus and then Haiti, and maybe all the way to BLM. And then other universalism, the state-sponsored official universalism, that is an excuse for colonialism and imperialism, and that is an excuse for racism. So perhaps that's the best way to look at it. But the way it's taught, it's certainly a way to try to negate history and the history as practiced on the ground, and to negate race.
Yeah, this is interesting. And there's a part of me that wonders, and we don't have to address this now, but there's a part of me that wonders if prominent Black intellectuals from the U.S., Zora Neale Hurston, James Baldwin, who spent time working creatively, intellectually, in places like Paris. I wonder if their decision to go to Paris for these reasons was somehow influenced by this idea that, France embraces this idea of universalism, of universal human rights. My race is less of an issue, will be less of an issue if I go there. I'll be treated humanely. I mean, I wonder if that influenced the decision of these thinkers to go there. Anyway, do you think, Oliver, that France has in any way realized this idea of universalism, not necessarily the brand that is more closely tied to colonialism, but the brand that you might associate with, for example, the anti-racist movement right now in Paris, or BLM, or does this just kind of remain a kind of mythological pipe dream that really has never been tangibly realized anywhere in the country?
And I'm wondering as well, Oliver, as you respond to Marcus's question, and brother, I'm wondering, can it be reached? You know, can we reach this ideal? Is it possible? How should we continue to kind of wrestle with this idea of universalism? And I can't help but think of how it might connect, Oliver, with even our own Declaration of Independence and this idea of all men created equal, seen as something of a universal idea as well. But please respond.
Well, let's see. We've got a lot of things here. I did want to respond about Paris being a haven for African-American intellectuals, because I think that's a very good point. For example, Sartre mentions the fact, and he had Richard Wright as a very good friend, Baldwin was in Paris, Chester Himes, but it was much easier at that time, the immediate post-World War II, to be tolerant of Black men, for example, and women in that Paris, because all the people who were genuinely oppressed were in the colonies. So there was sort of this artificial space. And also, France liked to give itself the moral high ground with respect to the United States of America, but never criticized their own practices. So even at that time, there were segregated hospitals for Algerians, for Muslims, in France, in the metropole. So this was a lot of sort of diplomacy in a way to criticize the United States. In Paris was a sort of an outlier compared to what was going on in the whole French Empire. So moving on from that, with respect to universalism and is it possible? Well, you know, one way to think about it, of course, is that every struggle against racism, against brutality, against violence, against this rewriting of history is in fact a battle for universalism, right? Fanon talks about this desire ultimately to join humanity as a collective. And so, but you can only go get to universalism if you fight racism, if you fight colonialism, and if you fight historical, what I would call negationism, right? The negation of the historical past. Now, as far as French universalism goes today, French universalism is really the French presence all over the world in its former colonies. And that is extremely problematic. It is the French flag flying in Guyana, a small enclave of land off of Latin America. It's the French flag flying in Guadeloupe, in Martinique, but also in the Pacific Ocean, in Tahiti, in New Caledonia. This is a universalism, but it's also the remnant of the colonial empire. It's also French interests all over Western, mostly Western Africa, and in the former colonies. It's the fact that the currencies of this country, it's called the ECO, is, you know, for all intents and purposes, controlled by the French bank and indexed to the euro. So we have a new form of oppression, which is sort of a neo-colonialism, where the colonial task has been subcontracted to local elites and to the benefit of French corporations. In a way, that is French universalism today. In another way, we have intellectuals, we have great figures from Martinique, from Guadeloupe, and from Africa who resonate because they write in French and they talk to a counterculture, a resistance to this. But as far as a perfect universalism, can we get there or not? I would defer to the both of you.
Well, you're listening to the Watterson Harvest Show on Blue Ridge Public Radio. We'll be back after a short break. Stay with us. You're listening to the Watterson Harvest Show on Blue Ridge Public Radio. We're discussing the global impact of the Black Lives Matter movement, woke culture, and racial justice protests in the United States. Our guest is Dr. Oliver Gloag, an associate professor of French and Francophone Studies at UNC Asheville. And Oliver, it's just really good to have you here. And thank you all in the audience for staying with us. Well, you know, Oliver, you just made a statement that really stands out to me, that really just caught my attention, and especially as a historian. You said the negation of the historical past. And it seems like, you know, that's something that we're really good at, of just ignoring what the historical past has been. So is that how we can look at France's response to social justice movements that are taking place globally now? Are you surprised by how French politicians and French intellectuals, it seems from both the left and the right, are responding to social justice movements globally?
Yeah, and just to add to Darren's question, Oliver, just quickly, if you would, I'm curious to hear from you, where does this negational power come from, right? What is it exactly that France is doing that accomplishes this historical negation, right? Because it seems to me that that, you know, it's one thing to sort of point to or name negation as a kind of nationalistic strategy that France is engaged in right now. And I think it's another kind of thing, a kind of helpful thing to think about how exactly this you know, these forms of historical negation are accomplished. So Oliver, please.
Well, this falsification is the motto of one of the great French thinkers of the 19th century, Ernest Renan, who said that nation was built on denial. In fact, he insisted that a nation was built on falsification of the historical record. And this is sort of gospel for the heads of state. This denial, there are so many examples of it. And going back, because it does explain the reaction and the force of the French reaction to the murder of George Floyd. But the French have negated the concrete examples are, for example, Aimé Césaire, who is a thinker, a poet, a playwright, a huge figure in French anti-colonialism, who was born in Martinique, who died about 15 years ago. He wrote a very famous text called The Discourse on Colonialism. He wrote it in the 50s. It was withdrawn from the national baccalaureate examination sponsored by the state in the early 2000s by the Ministry of Culture. You can no longer study this text. It is no longer an official text. It has been withdrawn. It has been effectively banned. Even though you can buy it in bookstores, you cannot study it in schools. So that would be exhibit 464, if I were to be facetious. But there is a chronic unwillingness to look at this past. And so Macron's interventions, the article you mentioned, Darren, speaks to that directly. And what's interesting is that there's this notion that these anti-colonial, quote unquote, woke thinkers are all American. Many of them were French. Fanon was from Martinique in France. Césaire was from Martinique in France. So this is not something that's coming from America. But the way the French state deals with it is by negating it, minimizing it, and in response to the murder of George Floyd, there was a law passed, no, not a law passed, but a bill proposed. I don't think it passed, it made it into law, to ban the filming of police. Because this is really the ostrich policy, right? You ban the filming of police by demonstrators. Now, all this being said, there are people who are fighting this culture of state-sponsored denial. There's a historian, Françoise Vergès, who writes extraordinarily important books on French colonial denial. But there is also a minister in 2001 from Guadeloupe. And she passed a law, she successfully wrote a law and it passed into law stating that the slave trade was a crime against humanity. And although it's largely symbolic, there are penalties associated with making the apology for slavery, and it's a first step. So there are people who, within French academe, within the French government, in some sections of it, are fighting for that recognition. But they are by far the minority. This is not part of the common discourse. But there are people out there in France who are fighting this this propensity to negate.
Yeah. Yeah, and your missus, the scholar you mentioned, Oliver, who writes about slavery as a crime against humanity, is striking to me when you consider, for example, that I'm thinking also about our recent shows on reparations. When you consider the fact that after the successful Haitian Revolution, right, what does France demand of Haiti? Reparations, right? And so Haiti ends up paying like somewhere around $21 billion in reparations to France for liberating right themselves. So, but anyway, I'm also curious to hear from you, Oliver. So it seems to me that, and I think we kind of see this in the anti-racism movement in France. It seems to me that that France seems to be, you know, despite all of these policies, a diverse country, and this seems to be the case increasingly so. So I'm wondering whether this is actually the case from your perspective as a Frenchman, and what this might bode, right? What this might signal for France's future, right? So you have, so if in fact we do have this increasingly diverse European country, right? This is increasingly diverse European nation, with these policies that essentially make it very easy to essentially ignore that diversity, right? You can't talk about it statistically. You can't, you know, study it numerically. What does that mean in your opinion?
And Oliver, before you answer that, Marcus's question becomes even more important for me, because I was thinking the same thing based on a comment that you made earlier. Because if I read your comment, or if I was hearing it correctly, that France has been able to avoid some of these real hard conversations around race because it was always something that was in some other place in the colonies. But it seems now that the country is confronted with it in a very different way. It's right there in your face. And is it the increasing diversity of France that is driving this?
I think it is. And I think this is a crucial development. And this demographic change, which is largely due to immigration. But we can't understand immigration, of course, without looking to history. So when France goes to Algeria or to Gabon, and invades it, occupies it, forces people to learn French as a language, makes that economy, for all intents and purposes, export only. When you grow up as a young woman or as a young man, the place to go, of course, is the place where the wealth of that country has gone to, which is France, and it's the language you speak. And so immigration is a consequence, a logical consequence of imperialism. And so here we have this new generation of France also, while it was rebuilding during World War II, called people from its colonies to help rebuild France that was well nigh destroyed by World War II. So there's also that paradox. And so we do have a very different makeup in France, which should be a crucial opportunity. You know, Islam is the second religion in France, but do you know Arabic is not taught in French schools by and large. Although, of course, you know, there's not a direct correlation between Islam and speaking Arabic, but in the French context, there usually is. And I think that ultimately this demographic pressure is going to change. And we see already members of government who are more diverse. There's a fascinating political figure, Daniel Obono, who comes from Gabon, who was born in Gabon, who does extraordinarily important work, and she's a Black woman. And the French establishment has a very hard time dealing with her. And she's the constant target of racist attacks, racist comments, and she fights back, and she is in the French Parliament. So this is a battle, but I think you're both right. This is a new France that's coming, a new France with different cultures, with different histories, and I think ultimately we should leave pessimism for better times, and we should hope that France can really open itself up and look at its history by looking at all its people.
Well, Oliver, I really appreciate that. And just the whole conversation, we could continue this. There's never enough time. But one of the things I'd like to ask you as we get ready to end here, this show, and we definitely have to have you back to continue this conversation. But I wonder, as France becomes more diverse, and this concept of universalism, could we possibly see one day, do you believe that we could possibly see one day a person of color as president of France?
That's a very good question, because you don't have persons of color who are heading political parties. But again, the example of Danielle Obono, I think, is important because she's a part of a new generation. Could we? I don't know. That's a difficult answer. I think that America could be, in this instance, more of a progressive country than America. Remember, we were talking about this new immigration. There are political parties who run against it, and there's an undercurrent of xenophobia in French politics that runs the gamut. It transcends the left and the right. So every president of the Fifth Republic has made their racist statement to kowtow to a strong majority of the white French population. And we should never forget that. From Mitterrand, who created internment camps for immigrants, to Jacques Chirac, who complained about the smells in Arab neighborhoods. I mean, every single president has made a comment that's been sort of complicated with that respect. So a Black president, we'll see.
Well, Oliver, again, Marcus and I want to thank you for joining us today. That's an interesting speculative way to kind of end this show, Marcus. We didn't leave much time for you and I to kind of wrap up the show with any commentary from the ideas that have emerged from the conversation with Oliver. But we're definitely going to come back to this. And Oliver, we'd love to commit you right now to coming back and continuing this conversation with us.
I would very much love to do so. I always enjoy speaking with you.
All right. Thank you. Well, thank you, Oliver, again. Thank you for being here. And as we get ready to close this program out, we'll do it as we always do to remind you that the Watterson Harvey Show is produced at Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville, North Carolina, in partnership with the Institute for the Promotion of Human Understanding.
And you can listen to our podcast on BPR.org, the BPR and NPR One mobile apps, and on Apple Podcast and Google Play.
Also, you can follow us and get in touch on Facebook and Twitter as you are doing, or you can write us at whshow@bpr.org. Take care.
Take care.